me get started.
Let's do it.
Do it.
Good.
My name is Steve Barnes. I'm moderator for this panel, which is on forms of plot structure. So I would enjoy it very much if my honored co-panelists would, let's say starting down at that end, introduce themselves and make a brief opening statement.
I am Matt Youngmark. I write epic novel-length choose-your-own-adventure books for grown-ups. Yeah. So plot structures obviously can get pretty non-traditional, and I'm interested to talk about some of the ways that you can use a really weird structure to tell a really interesting story. I also write a daily webcomic called Conspiracy Friends. So two very different formats, very different ways of plotting, and I also have plotted a couple of traditional novels, one of which I'm actually writing.
Nicely phrased. I like the word actually in that. I'm Mike Selinker. I'm predominantly known as a game and puzzle designer. I've written games like the Pathfinder Adventure card game and Betrayal at House on the Hill, and I was a creative director for Dungeons & Dragons and stuff like that. I wrote this. Speaking of Choose Your Own Adventure, this is The Maze of Games. It is a Solve Your Own Adventure. It is a puzzle novel where the pages are in the wrong order. And you have to solve your way through the book to put the novel back together. It's not a choose your own adventure in that there are no dead ends anywhere. Mm-hmm. But it is, pretty different, I guess. So, this was the first novel I ever wrote. So, you should try writing novels with the pages in the right order. That's my advice.
Hi, everyone. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm a professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York. I teach courses in creative writing and fantasy and science fiction and others. Also an author. My first novel was a couple of years ago. Second novel, Icarus, is a graphic novel being released in a couple of months, and I just signed a three-book deal with the Ed Greenwood Group for a trilogy starting next year, which is exciting. A series of short stories in various places. And my other hat is that I co-host a podcast with Brad Bollier called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, which interviewed this gentleman about The Maze of Games a few months back.
I approve of this podcast, and you should all listen to it right now.
Oh, thank you. Awesome. All right, well, that's all I need to do. If you want to know more about that, people like Mike, Kish Johnson, James Patrick Kelly, Patrick Rothfuss, Brandon Sanderson, just recently, Ann Leckie and Cameron Hurley. And if you want to know more about that, you can check us out at speculatesf.com.
All right. My name is Susan DeFreitas. I am an independent editor with Indigo Editing and Publications based in Portland. I work a lot with authors one-on-one to turn their sprawling, brilliant masses of novels into stories with structures that work in terms of their appeal and immersive reading potential, satisfaction, especially at the end. I am also a writer myself. I work in both literary and science fiction and fantasy.
And my name is Stephen Barnes, and I've written and taught writing for 30 years or something like that. So I love this crowd. This is great. I get the feeling you guys are live wires, too. So what I'm going to try to do is I want to set my panelists loose as rapidly as possible, and set the audience loose as rapidly as possible, and have you guys asking questions that my panelists can then answer, because that kind of dynamic interaction is what's going to make this best for all of you guys. So I would love it if my panelists would make a brief statement about their attitude towards plot structure, and perhaps even giving us a brief description of their favorite plot structure and why that is their favorite. So, once again, we can either start down at that end or whoever would like to speak first. Okay.
Hey, grenade.
Go for it.
I was trying to bounce it back.
I know.
No, I'm going to say, because I've read these novels,
when you meet if you pick up a really pretty girl at a bar, and she says, let's go to my room, be ready to say yes.
Amen. because I've written three of these so far, the Choose Your Own Adventure plot structure for me is so much more than just like those books that were written for little kids.
Yeah.
For example, the new book that I just wrote, Time Travel Dinosaur, it's written so that every time you make a choice, you split the timeline. And then basically you get to go to different centers and see what different versions of you are doing as the multiverse is collapsing. And tell a story through not just a random chance of what happens to you, but the more times you read, the more you see different aspects of what's going on in the book and see different parts of the storyline from different angles. And as a writer, I can't control what order you're going to read the whole story in, but I can control, like, you know, what some of the outcomes are. So I can set things up, and you might either read something first and then get the payoff later in a whole different part of the book and be excited, or get that part first, and then when you read the setup for it, you're excited because you already know what happens. So structurally, it's really interesting, and you can do some kind of things that that you can't do in a traditional novel. And I think That's my favorite way to tell a story.
Cool.
Great.
I grew up with that as a form of storytelling, and so I kind of hit a point where I expected there would be a lot more interactive fiction when I got done with Choose Your Own Adventures, and it wasn't there, right? Mm-hmm. This generation, the current generation, is awash in interactive fiction. And the reason The Maze of Games was possible, I showed this book around, the early draft of it, in like 1995, and all the publishers in the world went, I don't know what you're talking about. But suddenly in 2013, 14, and 15, this is a really, this is actually fairly familiar structure to people, that things are not in the right order, that there are broken elements. Movies like Time Code and other things like that just allow you to see, you don't have to obsess about reading things left to right anymore, right? And so I've seen tons of different directions, and they all influenced this book in many ways, and I just think we're living in an amazing time for the reinvention of the plot structure.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that. When I first get started in my creative writing course, the structure that everyone, I think, is generally initially familiar with is the sort of curve that goes up like this, right? As you're starting from an introduction, you gradually build, and you reach a climactic moment, and then it kind of goes back down like that. Yes. Yes, exactly. That's one of the things that people are initially familiar with, and the problem is that's a structure which incorporates some of the plots that are out there, but there are numerous plots that, first of all, do many different things than that, and there are some plots which actually actively work against it. And I agree with Mike that over time, more people have been trying more of those things. Partially, I think this is a result of the influence of games on literature, actually, because I think things, as we talked about when Mike was on the show, as games have intersected and more with storytelling in both directions, which is not to say that games didn't tell stories before, but I think there's more of a conscious focus on games as narrative. You've seen people sort of going back and forth into those directions. So not just people who had game design who are now writing books like Mike, but people in the other direction who are actively working on games and being influenced in both directions. So there is more of a decentering plot structure than you had before. One of my favorite plot structures that I happen to like and has existed for a long time is what they often call the duopart plot structure. And basically what that is sort of like the diagram that you just showed, except there's two of them that are working in parallel. And essentially they are following the exact same events in the plot, but they're being perceived in vastly different ways depending on the person in question. Over a two-book or two-work arc, you sometimes get this most of all, like Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow, for example, where the people who are interacting with that plot are seeing things in a different way. Or two of my favorite works to compare to each other, Beowulf the Epic Poem and Grendel, John Gardner's book, in which the same events, literally the same events that are overlapped, take place in the same way. The only difference is, bless you, the perspective and motivation within which these characters see each other. So Grendel understands the acts that happen in Beowulf much differently, although he does the same things. If you were looking at them from the outside, you'd say, okay, Grendel goes over and then he invades Heorot and then he's, you know, killing the guards and he's doing all these terrible things and then Beowulf rips off his arm. But how Grendel feels about it obviously changes everything that you might have understood about that tale. So I like that notion of the plot structure because the same structure is sort of built into play, but what matters is the perspective, the part of the ladder, if you will, right, that people are seeing on both sides of it. So that's one of many, many different kinds, but that's, you know, when you asked what's my favorite, that's something that stood out to me.
Okay. Ah, interesting ideas coming down the line here. I really like this. So I have to say that I, too, am a fan of innovative plot structures. I was a big fan of Choose Your Own Adventure games, and I fully, or books growing up, and I fully expected to see immersive, you know, to see games and fiction meld. In my time. And it's cool to see that that is finally, that dream of, like, my high school years is finally starting
that
to happen.
That long dream.
And we saw that, you know, start to get a little traction with the ideas behind the hypertext. Mm-hmm. But that was also, like, another little offshoot that I expected to see grow that never really went anywhere. There's so much potential with these branching structures that are not so linear. And yet, at the same time, a great example, I think, from literature, kind of before we started thinking about, you know, choose-your-own-adventure, et cetera, games, is a book called Hopscotch by Julio Cortazar.
So we talked about that, too.
The single greatest impact on this book.
And it's a fabulous, but you can read it in two different ways, right?
Yep.
You can read it from beginning to end, or you can follow the system of numbers at the bottom of pages, right?
If you take nothing out of this panel, if you don't write down the word hopscotch, you've made a
mistake. Hopscotch is great.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And part of what's beautiful about that is that it hits you in different emotional ways, right? And I think part of the danger that we get into when we start to experiment with form and structure, or whatever, it's like puzzles, right? And it's up here. It's this kind of stuff. Whereas part of what works about traditional plot structures is that they often speak to character development and the heart. So as somebody who works with a lot of different authors on a lot of different books, although I am a huge fan of innovative structures, I say understand traditional structures. Mm-hmm. You know, they have endured the natural selection pressures of our human evolutionary, you know, storytelling culture handed down through many years. And you can look at Freytag's Pyramid, you can look at the hero's journey. We had a great discussion about that earlier. You can look at traditional tragedies. These are all forms that work really well. But if there's one thing I would submit to you as being a basic unit, a spine with which you can build almost any creature, I would say it's the plot arc and it's the character arc. So.
How many of you are writers? Excellent. Really, really good. Good. Love you guys. This is perfect. So we're just having a conversation about friends and family.
Yeah, that's how it is.
Okay. In my opinion, the best writing teacher in the world, by some definitions, is Robert McKee. Wrote a book called Story. More people have successfully built careers and award-winning screenplays, award-winning stories on this one man's teachings than any other single instructor I know. And that's not the only standard for quality, but I think it's a fine one. And he says that there is, imagine a pyramid. And in this pyramid, at the top of the pyramid, is about 60% of what we see in storytelling. It's what we call the arc plot. More or less the hero's journey. You know, objective, obstacle, outcome. You know, situation, character, objective, opponent, disaster. Character in a situation with a problem, their efforts to solve the problem, or a series of revelatory, increasing failures leading to a precipitating event, making necessary a solution followed by a reward. You know, that stuff. Just that stuff. That's the arc plot. Okay. Then down in a corner over here is what's called mini plot. That's where you take the spine of the story and you shrink it down so that most of the story is really the character interaction. It's small, quiet moments. It's ordinary people. You know, the arc plot over here, that's Die Hard. Okay? Ordinary people. Donald Sutherland is simply watching this slow motion explosion going on in his family. He's going to have to make a choice. Does he save his marriage or does he save his son? And he is an apparently passive protagonist with tremendous internal dynamism as he's sorting his way through this. Then you have, over here in this corner, you have anti-plot. And this is, it seems to me, what's being discussed here. The deliberate deconstruction of the traditional plot structure, which in film and in novels is appreciated mostly by extremely educated people.
Yep.
People who really understand plots, so they understand the games you're playing with what we expected to happen next, okay? This top thing here, arc plot, those are blockbusters. That's where you're going to make most of your money. Those are going to be your bestsellers. Down here, mini plot, those are the award ceremony. You're going to get your awards down here.
Yep.
Okay? And over here in this corner, anti-plot, that's where you're going to get critics raving at
right.
you. And
that's
you're going to be
right.
toast to the avant-garde.
Notice how that's the bottom.
No. But I will occupy this bottom.
It's also foundational.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, but what you have to realize is that it's possible to make a very good living in any of these corners.
Absolutely.
You're going to make the most money up here. You're going to get the most awards here, and you're going to have the most approval by your peers.
You will also get the most competition here at the top, right?
Yes. That basically, well, I think you have different kinds. I don't know.
You'll basically get, I mean.
You get a wide corner where you don't make any money.
Yeah.
but if you're good at what you do, if you write a story that transfers emotion to your reader, because that's all you're trying to do, whatever technology you're using to do that, if you can imbue your reader with an emotion, and you're telling the truth about your experience, you're not trying to be clever, you're telling the truth about your experience, your reality, what you think things are, then making money is just marketing. Okay? And so there's a legitimate way to do it at any point. And I would suggest don't blame money on which aspect of this you decided to go for, because there are plenty of people who've been successful at any of them. So that's kind of what I would say, you know, about that. So your characterizations are saying what you think about what it is to be a human being, but your plot structure says what you think reality is. How, because all a plot is how does reality react to somebody's efforts to solve a problem? Mm-hmm. They do this, and reality does this. They do this, and there's your plot structure. Okay, and so you're saying, what is the nature of reality? What is the ethical structure of the universe? What's your cosmology? You know, and then what is humanity over here? So the interaction of those things, this is why it's so critical for writers to have a philosophy, to be aware, to think themselves through. Some people would say have a politics. I say, whatever. So those are the ways I would look at this. Now, obviously, listening to you guys, we could talk amongst ourselves about this. Mm-hmm. What I would really like to do is see whether or not there are writers out here who would like to address specific questions about their work or their careers or plot or whatever to whatever member here or all of us, and so that you guys walk out of here thinking it was the best panel I had at this convention. This lady right here.
So something that I'm currently working on involves figuring out a specific magic system that has been developing over history. And so what I'm looking at is having sort of the flashbacks of here's an important aspect of that magic system, and then an overarching plot with a specific character who is, in modern times, learning about that magic system. And as new aspects come up, kind of going back to this is what happened in history. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Am I just seriously making this way too confusing?
I don't think so.
No.
That's a totally solid structure.
We've done that. That kind of story is out and about. I mean, Anne Rice did it in with the Second Queen of the Damned thing. I mean, you know, it's not like flashbacks are somehow not part of the standard plot structure. They're actually built directly into it. It just happens to be, like, the plot structure is happening on top of that, and then there are little diversions, like stalactites coming off of the thing, right? But you're not actually losing your normal plot structure that way.
In fact, in a meta level, you're more or less doing with something like that what people do anyway when they're exploring history in a novel. If you look at, like, The Lives of Locke and Mora, that's a book in which there is a city that's built on top of an ancient culture that gets discovered in part as the book continues, and it's as if they continue to stumble upon these treasure troves, right? These things about, I wonder what this is for, and what is this machine, and what is this crazy device, and what do these things do, and that informs their decisions in the present. That's kind of, on a meta level, what you're doing as an author anyway, because you know where the magic system is that these people did in history. You know the way that their ancient history that isn't magic related sort of connected to this world in the past. You don't, hopefully, give your reader all of that information because they don't need to know it. That's when you run into the source book problem where you're writing a source book for a game system as opposed to writing a novel. Your readers don't need to know all of that up front, but they do need to know that you know it so that when the characters find it, it feels like it's organically real. So in that sense, no, I don't think it's too confusing. I think the only time it gets confusing is when you feel the need as the author to leap in front and photobomb the experience, if you will. Like, here's what's going on, readers, by telling you about all of that. That's where you don't want to do it. But if you have the system in place that your characters are finding over time, that, to me, is simply good writing because it's developing this context that there's a much larger world beyond the surface of what the reader sees.
Mm-hmm. It's also the question of, like, is the history dramatized? Is the history a story itself?
Yeah, sure.
Right? Yeah. Because that has to be part of it. And part of it, too, is, like, Are you spending enough time in each time frame that we have a kind of a dog in each race, right? AS by its possession, like, there's a story in the front and there's a story in the past. And that's a really good example of a book where we're both so invested mm-hmm. in both time frame stories, and they hinge upon each other so much that we're never pissed when we're pulled back into the present, and we're never upset when we have to go to the past.
A good example of a movie version of that, by the way, is the movie Dead Again, which does exactly that, and literally tells two parallel stories, one in the past and one in the future, and boy, when they meet, that is one hell of a twist, one of the better ones, I think, in film.
And that is a cool climax.
Yeah, oh,
a non-traditional climax.
Also great acting, too, but the plot is amazing.
I think this has covered a lot of what you were saying, I think, but there was one thing that I wanted to say. I wanted to ask a question. Are you published yet? Okay. Now, and this is something I tell students all the time. If your act is going to be to juggle 5 chainsaws, start with 3 scarves. Okay? Because you want to set a bar that's low enough that it's a little bit of a stretch, but you're not too confused. You're not allowing fear to hit you. Because you can see the part of you that does not want to succeed, and we've all got one, will deliberately try to set a bar that is just a little too big for you when you're doing it so that you can fail and it can say, see, don't bother trying. So the story you're talking about sounds like let's say, 5th grade work, okay? And what you want to make sure is that are you absolutely positive you're out of kindergarten? Okay, are you sure? If you can handle and sell a simple story, then begin to add those levels of complexity and going back and so forth and so on. Just be sure of that. If you do this and it doesn't come out right, do not assume that you don't have the talent. Assume maybe I tried a little bit too much. Let me scale it down a little bit. Okay? That's the only thing I'm worried about there. This lady right here.
Okay, so I just have a really, really quick question, because we mentioned that the plot arc and stuff is the reality in which the characters are reacting, correct?
The perspective that I'm offering.
So if I were to strip the characterization down to the bare bones, the character starts in one place, has to end in some place different, has to be faced with obstacles, and has to just learn something along the way, yes?
Mm-hmm. Okay. You read your Campbell.
And has to absolutely crash and burn.
That's kindergarten.
Right. Yeah.
You get that, you can tell a very, very complex, brilliant story using that most simple of structures.
Yep.
And it will really work.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. George Lucas is the top level Campbellian we have, and he decided that after doing three movies, that he would invert the plot structure by giving you 3 prequels at the front that explain everything you just saw. You can quibble to how you feel about that. But that was a massive decision to say, I completely get what I'm doing with the Campbell story arc.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to tell you something, I'm going to take a little more effort and make something even broader. Right.
At the risk of broadening that quibble, I'll say that one of the reasons that the 3 movies, many believe, did not work as well as they could have is because the first 3 movies were set in the exact right place. They gave you enough history and information that you could grab onto the characters.
Sure.
You had a sense that there was a much larger world beyond them, but you didn't have to know every single aspect of what built them up. And as a consequence, there's enormous tension about who Darth Vader is, what the Emperor's ultimate goal is, whether Luke Skywalker will accomplish what he needs to. The mini-arcs, will Han Solo become someone that you actually care for, or will he remain a group? Some mercenary, that sort of thing, right? So in a way, that's what just made me think of it. Those 3 prequels are really interesting, in part because if they don't work, part of the reason they don't is because the 3 in the middle were really the best part of that story, in a way.
The
I don't
three,
know, maybe.
The 3 in the middle.
In the middle. Right, we'll see, right?
So you mentioned a character crashing and burning as part of this bare bones, as you said, plot structure. And what if in this theoretical plot structure, you're supposed to start with a character just kind of going on their journey. What if you start with crashing and burning?
Many things start there.
Sure. Yeah,
I dropped one knee and fired twice, you know, or I, you know, I've been paralyzed with depression for a month. Start a story with that line. Just remember that the full one of the analogies that I use is that the full 10-step hero's journey that I use is like the 88 keys of a piano. You don't make music by hitting them
in order.
You understand the emotional impact of each step, and then you play them in a way that allows you to express yourself and your story.
Yep.
But you, when you're starting as a writer, you write several stories that are just sheer archetype, playing the scales. You're playing your scales. You're getting the basic components of your craft to the level of unconscious competence, which is where it has to be for you to do art in anything. You can't do look ma no hands until you can ride a bicycle.
Yeah, which is
that's the only thing I was concerned about with that lady. She's trying to do look ma no hands. Just want to make sure, can you ride a bike?
Which is why James Joyce writes Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man before he writes Ulysses. He needs to know, and way before he writes Finnegan's Wake, because he needs to be able to write something in a way that makes sort of regular narrative coherent sense before he goes to something which decenters narrative and then super decenters narrative. If anyone knows what the hell's going on in Finnegan's Wake, those things happen in that way.
Well, that's why Salvador Ali mastered realism.
Yeah. Right.
Before surrealism.
Sure,
yes. Right.
Sure.
Yeah, there was a line in one of John D. McDonald's Travis McGee novels where he's talking to an abstract artist who is demanding respect, and he throws her a pad of paper and says, draw that tree out there. If you can draw that tree, I'll admit you're an artist. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're fake.
He didn't do it. He didn't just do it in his novels. He was in a cocktail party, and somebody said, they asked him who he was. He said, I'm a writer. And this woman said, oh, I've always wanted to take time. I've always wanted to have the time to write. And he said, his response was, that's funny. I've always wanted to have the time to do brain surgery. And he sort of left her staggered as he walked away.
Sure.
And the lesson there is to write, to be a writer, you have to write.
Yes.
This is not a good approach to brain surgery.
No.
We happen to be in a very different field.
If you take nothing from it.
This is along that line. The day I met Larry Niven,
yeah.
I said, hello, Mr. Niven, my name is Stephen Barnes, and I'm a writer. He looked at me and said, tell me a story.
Yeah.
Oh!
Yeah, no, that's how it works.
Like I said, chatting up the girl at the bar, and she said, let's go to my room.
I do this all the time. People will come up to me and they'll say, oh, yeah, I've got a game. I said, you have 15 seconds.
Yes.
And if I don't have a good idea of what the game is in 15 seconds and it sounds good, we can part company.
That's your elevator conversation.
Yeah,
that's the log line, isn't it?
Huh?
That's the one.
It's the log line. Yeah. Elevator conversation.
Yeah, the elevator
you got 15
pitch.
15 seconds.
Yep.
What if you accidentally ended up in the elevator with the editor of your dreams,
exactly.
And you have the time between floors and this is what my story is about?
Yeah.
That's the value of being able to understand plot.
And different people, have different approaches, but I won't start a book until I have that. I won't start a book what that book's about in that kind of nutshell.
And there are people who can do it. There are people who can write a book without knowing what the book is about.
Absolutely.
But once again, those are people who are operating at the level of unconscious competence.
Right.
Those skills can be learned. Yep. If you think that if I don't have the talent to do it just automatically, I can't do it, then that is simply unrealistic. Most of what you see in the world is the result of hard work over time, not intuitive genius. Who's the next question?
Well, I have one.
Yes, sir.
I'm a pretty strict hero's journey plotter. Mm-hmm. I come under a lot of fire with the argument that a lot of those archetypes are no longer applicable. Mm-hmm.
Not in this room, they're not.
Now, may I ask you a question, sir?
Uh-huh.
Who is it that is criticizing?
Is it the New Yorker? Because I would not be saying.
Send them dog poop.
People
that
are pitching a television show.
Where are these people? They're Hollywood people?
That industry, yeah.
Well,
because Hollywood uses art plots all the time. You may need to
disguise it a little.
Yeah, disguise it. You know, which aspect of it they're doing multi-layer, stuff in television right now. So it might be that your story is a little too simple. Television. Visual medium, because there's so much money there, is generally a level of skill above the publishing industry, I think, on average.
I was on a panel at Gen Con, the Writers' Symposium, with Bill Willingham. And what we were talking about the hero's journey. We were talking about, and we were going to this thing about Joseph Campbell and, the various aspects of the hero's journey. And he started by saying, the problem is that I think that Joseph Campbell, the hero's journey has been oversold and it's been overdone. And he goes into this big explanation as to why. And by the time we got to the end of the panel, the rest of us, many of whom did not think it had been oversold and had overtold it, had argued that a lot of fables is actually based upon the hero's journey and a sort of logic about it. And he was like, well, yes. I mean, that's of course, but I'm talking about the other. So there was in his mind, and this is nothing against Bill, I think what Bill was addressing is sort of what you're getting. In Bill's mind, he had this image of the academic version of the hero's journey, which rests on a pedestal somewhere, presumably at Harvard, where people sort of wander around it, and kind of look at it and bow down to it, when the truth is that the reason that we have these series of relatively consistent plots that we talked about, a structure that, as you mentioned, you like to work with authors because it is so successful, is there are variations, there are nuances, there are versions. The one that I gave you as an example, in a way, is itself the hero's journey, simply told from different perspectives,
yes.
Whether it be Beowulf or Grendel. And so if you put all those things together, what you end up with is you really are, in many cases, involved with some basic plot structures. It's the nuance and the way that you gussy up the outside, if you will, that's going to change the way it looks, but not that the form itself is fundamentally doesn't exist as a real form.
That, the hero's journey was abstracted from myth and folktales. Those are generally flat forms in terms of characterization. Right, Jeff Vandermeer has some great thoughts on flat versus three-dimensional, right? So they lend themselves very naturally to stories that are basic good versus evil, ingenue, takes his power, whatever. So maybe part of one of the ways of modernizing or disguising or, you know, making it less archetypal is just a little more gray on both good and bad characters. I don't know if that's applicable to your work, but that's something that came to mind.
That's actually that and what you said about the layering.
Yeah.
Is actually the two.
So I think that the academic you were referring to was on the panel is making what sounds like the way you're conveying is making a core conceptual error. He's saying these people are basing things on the hero's journey. There's correlation, there's not causality.
Right, right.
You know, that saying that somebody has the same germ that Louis Pasteur isolated in Paris doesn't mean that germ is a descendant of the germ that Louis Pasteur had.
Right.
The hero's journey was an observation of something, of an underlying reality.
Sure.
And that underlying reality, I would suggest, exists because we organize disconnected facts in a pattern, we try to make it a pattern that has some meaning to us. In other words, a hero's journey works because we recognize it from the pattern of our lives.
Yep.
That if you do not organize information in some way that is a recognizable shadow or variation or reflection or distortion of our lives, people look at it and it's like it's just a succession of images. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean anything. So I think that your task is the hero's journey is a straight thing. I can find it or elements of it in any book, movie, television, anything you throw at me, I can find it. And that doesn't mean that it was based on that. It means that my mind is going to find patterns there, whether you put them there or not. Otherwise, that movie will not appeal to an audience. You cannot show me any movie that actually creates an emotional change in an audience that does not have things that reflect our lives in one way or the other. It just doesn't work that way.
Can I say something about Bill Willingham's comment? Because I know Bill as well. He's got an amazing out in that he's built his entire story, Fables, on stories you already know.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those are mini versions of the hero's journey. They're all like fairy tales, and every one of them has the same plot arc.
Yep.
And so it's real easy, or it's not easy, but it's certainly helpful to have, if you're going to do this kind of new plot structure, to have something already laid down on the table that people can latch on to. And he actually did that. That's why Fables actually works, is because you don't need a long introduction to who Red Riding Hood is.
Yep.
You don't need, so he can take the time that we would otherwise spend telling you about who our characters are and veer a different direction.
Yeah, totally.
It's not a bad way to build something.
Yeah, I agree.
Good question. Panelists?
Well, since I'm in the midst of grading short stories right now, although I love my students, one big problem that I have is when students are dealing not really with a plot. They're not really dealing, in fact, with a story. They're dealing with an anecdote or a sketch, something which happens within a plot but is not itself a plot. So they sometimes are very good at giving me extremely detailed and thoughtful and even emotionally thought-provoking character portrayals, right? And they'll show me things about these characters, and I'll say, yes, that's tremendous. What happens? And then the end. What? You know, and I'm left thinking to myself, these characters would be great if they did something, instead of the equivalent of sitting on a stage chatting with each other. And one of the things that works the best is when plot and characters are in dialogue with each other. So one of the things that I talk to when I get students like this, I've had a couple of stories like this, is one of the things I make clear is there's no problem with the character that you want to have tell the story, because it's obvious you've thought quite a bit about that character. It's someone that they've obviously spent some time imagining in their mind and have been in some sort of dialogue with. But if the character doesn't go anywhere, doesn't do anything, doesn't functionally alter, doesn't shift, doesn't change, then what we're left with ultimately is a character that will remain in one place, both in our mind and on the page. The character won't matter to us because the character never did anything that mattered to them. So one of the things I talk about with my students on that is to, okay, where did these characters go then? Under what circumstances would they function? How would they develop if they encountered obstacle A, B, and C? And there have been a couple of occasions where I've even given a couple of random obstacles, and I've said, okay, so what happens if The best friend is kidnapped. What are they going to do now, this character of yours that you love so much? What would they do in that circumstance? Almost to sort of break the author out of this fear that I don't want to take my character out of the room because they might get hurt, and I love my character. You know, you want the character to be able to sort of function and condition. This is different from authors who want to beat the hell out of their
character. I'm not like that.
No, I know. I know. When you change from amateur to pro is when you hate your characters. No. But so one of the things I tell them is your characters will get even more depth, even more dimensionality if you can put them through an environment that happens, because what happens to them will make you care about the characters more than would be the case otherwise. So one common plot problem is to not really have a plot and to have mostly just characters themselves.
Well, there's other things. Sorry to jump in, but this was my biggest thing about Jupiter Ascending. I love this. I love the fact that it was a female protagonist. I love the fact that it had gorgeous sets and wonderful. She did nothing on her own. She didn't tell the guy. She was kidnapped. She was rescued by this guy. Everybody else is doing everything for her. Mm-hmm. She's not doing anything. Mm-hmm. Make sure that your character is
doing something.
Choosing something.
Yeah.
That's a really good point, and I feel like you and I could probably talk about this for hours. Yeah. Common problems with plots. One of the things is that plot generally has, like, something recognizable as a plot. It follows this kind of cause and effect order, right? It's kind of like, because of this, this happens. Because that happened, every single thing that happens has consequences. The consequences are important, right? That, it's like when you dangle a piece of string in front of your cat, right? Your cat wants to follow that thing. If you're interested at all in the neuroscience of fiction, that is one of the things that is shown. It's like we love to follow cause and effect because that is a very great evolutionary advantage to be able to follow cause and effect, right? And so that's something we recognize as a plot, right? Two, no character but in action and in reaction. Too often we have authors, you know, they fully imagine the entire life history, what the characters had for breakfast, all of their relations, like the entire universe in which they reside. But that's not revealed in action. For us to really believe, to see who a character is, we have to see them acting and reacting.
Right.
Right? And so when you get the nice resonance between things happening because that happened, character responds because of that causing another thing, right? You get this buildup, you get this harmonic resonance that accrues meaning, which is this magical emergent property, right? And one of the things, too, that I would add is that does the plot push the character to go where they fear to tread, right? Because that's where you extract emotion. And that's one of the things that interests me most, is how events can lead to actual emotion in your reader.
It's also when the characters are at their best and their worst, and that's what you want, is for characters to push beyond the envelopes of their normal lives.
Mm-hmm. Anybody? I would say that the biggest problem I see most often in plotting is that the characters don't really want anything.
Mm. Yeah.
And if they want something, there's nothing specifically that's standing in their way. And I think that quite often this mirrors emotional issues that the writers are working on within themselves. Mm-hmm. And so what I usually suggest that they do is that they find a time in their lives when they were frozen, not knowing what to do, but managed to do something anyway, because we've all had those moments. If you got to being an adult, you have moved through your emotional issues many, many, many times. Mm-hmm. Write a story about someone in that situation, showing them going through, I'm just trapped here, I don't know what to do or how I should do it, that you take the very lack of clarity that you have about what one should do in their lives that devils your work, make it explicit in the structure, write a story about that. Because now you're telling a story to yourself, and you're doing the once upon a time, there was someone who, and you're facing your own dragons. And I think that when you do that, you're writing, you start touching art, because you're actually expressing who it is you are at the same time that you are doing jujitsu on your own demons. Mm-hmm. At the same time that you're telling a story that is valid and you're entering the cultural conversation, this is how we can grow up as human beings. So I see that so often, that basic dynamism that's not in the story, it isn't in their lives either, And if you will engage with it properly, you can uncover the fear that's stopping you from admitting that you want something. Yeah. Admitting that you care about something. I'd rather just be blasé. I'm not going to admit that I really care, that I want love, that I want success, that I want whatever the story is about. Because if I say I want it, then I have to admit I care. Now I can be hurt. So whatever it is that you're doing, look at what's stopping you. Like I said, the structure of the stories you're telling talks about the structure of the universe, but it also will ultimately reveal your philosophy about what the universe is. So your storytelling, I think that the writer reveals themselves in the way they play with the plot. It says a lot about what do you think reality is.
And the thing is, too, when you push your characters to the deepest, darkest place for them and build a believable way out of it, great writer Barry Lopez would say you are actually healing the world. You have made a map.
Yes.
That others can follow.
I see a really different problem. I would answer, those are all excellent things to approach. I see a very different kind of writer, I think, coming to me a lot. My problems, usually the thing that I have to fix most of all is pacing.
Yeah.
Plot is a thing that you can easily graph out, even if it's crazy nonsense like the one I have here. But if you don't know when things need to occur, you haven't actually given your reader any reason to move forward. And so there are two approaches to this that I've tried to teach people. The first is the strict Pavlovian approach, which is give them exactly what they want when they're expecting it. Right? So a straight blockbuster-style approach is... We haven't had a car chase for a while. Yeah. Let's have a car chase.
Every 10 minutes.
I believe you just saw this movie, right? So we were sitting next to each other talking about the Fast and the Furious instead of anything important. Anyway, but seriously, that's real valuable. If you just say
2.5 hours of plot-free entertainment.
Yeah. What I would say is sometimes that's exactly what you want to do. You want to hit every single beat just like a metronome, right? And then, once you've done that, now you should spend some time trying to figure out what happens when you don't hit those beats. Yeah. What goes in that spot?
What do they expect to happen here? Because I've seen 1,000 stories of this kind. Now,
Now they're in some other space. What are you? They're now waiting for their reward. It's still Pavlovian. Right, but now you're going to give them something else that they didn't expect there.
Well, readers will love you if you give them what they want, just not in the way you expect.
Exactly. So that's a trick, and I hope I taught it to a bunch of people. It's pretty useful to know exactly what your audience would expect to happen, and then decide whether you want to give it to them.
Yep. I think we have time for another question or so. This lady right here.
So, I was wondering. Because I did what I'm not supposed to do as a first-time novelist, and I've endeavored on multiple main characters, and a lot of backstory that creates the presence of these multiple characters at this time, so that their presence moves my plot forward and puts them in a place to bring the whole arc of my story to completion. So if their background wasn't there, they wouldn't be there. If they all weren't there, the story wouldn't go forward because they all actually do carry certain archetypes to them. So, yes, here I am with 700 pages and starting my... down to 300 or something along those lines and be sane about it. Any advice on taking multiple points of view? You know why I had to get...
before they give you practical advice, I'd like to say work on the book, but also start working on some very simple short stories. Have you sold yet?
No, I haven't.
What you're talking about is such a common problem. I run into it so often, and it is akin to running the Boston Marathon before you have run around the block. Okay,
well,
you may have set yourself.
Everything.
That's the whole thing. That's what I said.
Let one of your characters have
that problem too. You know, deal with that because that is there's an avoidance going on there. Okay, and you step out of being a writer and look at my life. And say, you know, something. Who I am as a writer is not that much different from who I am over here too. So if you find that your projects are going on and on and on, deliberately set some smaller projects so you can get used to what it is to complete it completely.
Absolutely.
So finish your book. Do it, but also set yourself a task of writing one little short story every month. Just one, you know, like 3-page short story, 5-page short story.
I did do that.
And sell
I
them. Sell them. Yeah. But how my panelists now, please.
A couple things about that. First of all, I love the idea of working out concerns that you have in your life more generally in your fiction, because I think those things can actually solve, you know, can serve both issues. One thing I would suggest, and this is not something one can know until you actually look at the book, is to really, 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 really see if every one of those characters' viewpoints is completely distinct from every other one, because I suspect if you go back over and look at it, you would find that many of them can be compressed. One of the things you'll discover, especially first-time novelists will discover, is that they have all these different ideas that they think need to be conveyed through separate avenues. In many cases, what you'll discover is that actually many of those avenues can be combined so that you will have a single character, 2 or 3 or 4 characters as opposed to 15, 20, or 25, that are able to relate the same kinds of things that you wanted to express, except that instead of them being vastly different people, they are people who hold 2 different positions at 2 different stages of their life. A person who, for example, when they were younger, had a particular desire that they wanted to achieve. That desire is something which they never achieve, but it remains in their mind as something which they would like to pursue when they get older. Perhaps they think they've gone beyond it and they've grown up now and they have other desires, but those initial desires haven't left. And if you can compress those things together, number one, you cut down the 700-page thing a little bit. Number two, you make it more closely replicate what we go through. Because as Steve said, if we are here in our experience able to see, I remember when I was someone who wanted X, Y, and Z. I now, as an adult, remember that I want A, B, and C, but I haven't forgotten that I used to desire X, Y, and Z. And to a certain degree, that underpins who I am now. Then you can more closely replicate the reader's experience also. So it may not work for you, but I wanted to mention it because I often find multiple viewpoints can sometimes be compressed really useful.
I have a very different approach.
Write all of them.
Spreadsheets. Oh. Okay, I spend a ton of my life in Microsoft Excel. I have an assistant named Gabby who is capable of building serial killer walls that have Post-it notes attached to them with lines that lines that extend from things. Start by just building it, right? You're writing it, which is fabulous, great, but stop. And just build it. Build a skeleton, right? Figure out how everything connects to each other. And then you'll see the stuff that Greg is saying, right? Then you'll see, like, wait a minute, do I really need this? But until you see it all, until you know everything that's funneling into that thing, you're just writing. Like, you're just writing a thing you think you have to write, as opposed to something you actually have to write.
I'm writing the thing that I'm seeing, and I wouldn't be writing at all if I didn't see this young boy coming out in the mist and walking into
the car. What I could promise you is if you understood your story clearly enough, you could write it as a short story.
Oh, yeah.
That 700-page novel, I could put World War II into a 5-page short story.
I want to be on that panel.
I want to see you do that.
Yes, yes. Make it happen, NorwestCon. Make it happen.
Very briefly, okay? This is great advice you're getting over here. I'm going to give you some different advice, okay? My reach has always exceeded my grasp. I have always tried to do things that I was way beyond my ability. The key is not to give up when at first you don't succeed.
Absolutely.
And to keep maturing and keep working on it,
sure.
Okay? Two, I work with people who have 700-page novels that need to be 300-page novels all the time. And I have a laundry list of techniques for boiling it down, right? It's a way to give yourself an education in distillation, which is one of the major tools that you're going to need for all fiction moving forward. And I'll give you two off my laundry list, okay? Anybody else out there with giant, giant books? Okay? Number one, he asked you to think about whether you need all your characters, right? Think about this. Sometimes you can combine two characters into one and get a more complex, more interesting person who accomplishes all the same things in the plot with one person instead of two. Okay? Number two is that you write backstory so you understand it yourself. But once you already understand it, you can sublimate it, right? And usually convey it more in the present, less in the backstory, in a third of the words. So see if you can convey the backstory for each character in a third of the number of words. That's just straight exposition.
We have a. We're really making final statements now. Do you have one?
Yeah. Final statements. I would say on the subject of what we're talking about right now, I would say reach for the stars in terms of what you're like what she said. Like be on your grasp. Definitely stretch, because if you're not exciting yourself, you're not going to write a good story. Write the story that you would go out and tell all your friends. Oh my God, you have to read this. That's your goal. Like if you're not excited about what you're doing, then you know you're just going through the motions. So don't write for yourself first and foremost. Write, you know, the story that you need to read.
The final statement that I would make on this is that one of the advantages of writing short works is you don't have as much of ego invested. If you screw up, who cares?
Yeah, right.
It's a week of work rather than 5 years of your life.
Absolutely.
And what you need is to be able to crash and burn a lot of time without damaging too much. I'd also like to say that all of you have a flyer in your goodie bag for an online teleseminar that my wife, Sanadri Du, and I are going to be doing on exactly 2 weeks from now. Totally free. We're going to be talking about the hero's journey and plot structure and stuff. It's all in your goodie bags. And thank you so much for being a wonderful audience.
Thank you.